This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June. Happy June. We believe there's no time quite like summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry, and thank you for being part of the BGS and Good Country communities. Hello and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation. The BGS Podcast Network. It's me, Cindy House. I host this podcast. Hello. Today we are kicking off our Keyamo interviews. For the past 3 years, Lizzie Noe and myself have been invited aboard the Keyamo Cruise, which is a floating music festival that sails out of Miami into the Caribbean. This year's headliners: Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, Ricky Lee Jones, Patty Griffin, and the band Dawes, who we are talking to today. We had a blast this year. Thank you to everyone at Sixth Man and Keyamo for having us. Can't wait to come back. This was such a great conversation. We've got a couple more that we'll be sharing in our feed. Be sure that you subscribe so that you don't miss any of these Keyamo episodes. Before we get into Dawes, let's talk about our mailing list. You can sign up for our mailing list at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. We like to send a once-a-month email out to let you know who's coming up on the podcast, who's been on recently, and all of our thoughts and feelings. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We are on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. We are a listener-supported podcast. You can make a contribution, leave us a gift at basicfolk.com/donate. That link is also in the show notes. All right, we are so excited to kick off our Interviews at Sea series with Dawes. We had the chance to talk to brothers Taylor and Griffin Goldsmith aboard the Keyamo Cruise during its 18th voyage in March 2026 in front of a packed audience. The guys have been performing as Dawes since 2009. The band has been a duo since their 2024 album, Oh Brother, but the Goldsmiths have been singing and playing together their whole lives. Inspired by their musician father, Lenny Goldsmith, who toured as the lead singer of Tower of Power in the 80s, Taylor was never told that it was hard to play guitar or sing, so he just did it. He knew he wanted to be a professional musician. We talked about the ways that his musical career had turned out in ways that he had not expected. We also touch on how their singing has evolved over the course of their lives together. Both Taylor and Griff are fathers, so we, of course, ask about the freedom that comes with priorities changing in their lives and careers, as well as what toys they may have regretted ever letting their kids have. One thing that has been following Dawes around for the past year is the aftermath of the January 2025 Eaton fire. Both brothers and their parents suffered immense loss due to the fire that swept through Altadena, destroying thousands of homes and causing over 30 deaths. Griffin's son was born 2 weeks after the fire, a month early. Dawes became the musical face of the Los Angeles fires with the emotional performance on Jimmy Kimmel, the opening of the Grammys with Randy Newman's I Love LA, along with the supergroup featuring Sheryl Crow, Brad Paisley, Brittany Howard, St. Vincent, John Legend. They get into what the experience taught them about healing and getting to that place where this tragedy does not define them. We hear a bit about Taylor's love of collecting first editions and his fear of the comment section. We also wrap up with a very fun Which One lightning round. One thing to note, if you are not aware, Taylor Goldsmith's wife is the actress, singer, and America's sweetheart, Mandy Moore, which is important to know because we love Mandy Moore. This is the Mandy Moore fan club. We proclaim it on stage and we mean it. Before we get into the interview, let's listen to a clip from Dawes's latest album from 2024. They are working on a new one, but no details on any kind of release on that yet. But we'll check out this one, Strangers Sometime, from 2024's Oh Brother. Then we'll get to Dawes on Basic Folk.
I was geared up for obscurity, excited most specifically about knowing you'd soon reach for me and I'd be gone. You always took me to another place, part childhood, part outer space, but the naked truth of our face to face is just not what I want. Cause even when your body gets that close to mine, we're still strangers sometimes, we're still strangers sometimes. And even as you claim that you can read my mind, we're still strangers sometimes, we're still strangers sometimes.
Good morning, everybody. How's it going?
Good morning.
Welcome to Coffee Chats with Basic Folk.
That's right. I'm Cindy House.
I'm Lizzie Noem.
And we host a podcast called Basic Folk. It's honest conversations with folk musicians. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barb.
And thank you to the Bluegrass Situation for hosting our podcast and sending us on this amazing journey.
We're so excited to be here. I saved a couple of seats up front, but no one's going to sit in them. So if anybody wants a front row seat,
front row seat,
action,
come on down.
There's two seats. Sorry to cause a stampede.
And under those seats are the keys to a brand new Kia Sorento.
All right. I had this really amazing joke I wanted to tell last night, but I felt too shy about it.
So how about you tell it now?
I thought I would tell it now amongst friends.
Let's go.
Okay, I have a question for everybody. How is your semester at sea going? It was pretty good.
It was good. It was good.
Okay.
I'm really glad you really went for it creatively.
Thanks,
Cindy.
All right. So we are here today to talk to the Dawes boys. So we should bring them out on stage.
Let's
go. Please welcome Taylor and Griffin Goldsmith.
Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, y'all.
Welcome aboard.
Thanks for having us.
How is your semester at sea going?
So far, so good. I got a little woozy right when we took off yesterday, like minutes before our set. But then we got rained on for 45 minutes.
You got dumped on.
That's great. Yeah.
Felt great after that.
That's great.
Rock and roll.
Yeah, we keep texting the crew guys. Like, have you guys had a chance to make sure everything's working? We haven't heard back yet, but.
So cool. We're excited to talk about the band, talk about the last record. So the band is now a duo of brothers. That's you, Taylor
Indeed.
And Griffin. And you released your last album in 2024 titled Oh Brother. And on that album, Taylor's playing most of the songs with Griffin on drums and background vocals. And one thing that Dawes is known for are these sweet, sweet harmonies. So over the course of your lives, what has singing with each other looked like, and how is it different now?
I guess this is maybe a little banal, but it's something that we've been doing so long, I don't actually remember. Mm. You know, our father's a musician and like the best singer. I wish I could sing like him. He's an incredible singer. He's actually graced this boat. I don't know if anybody saw it.
Really? Oh my gosh.
All right.
Everyone saw him. he's hard to forget. If you've met him once, you certainly remember him. But we sang our whole lives, it seemed like. And then, formally, I kind of remember. I remember us around maybe like when I was 13 and he was probably graduating high school. That's kind of when I formally remember like actually learning about harmony singing and all of that.
But it wasn't like, you know, we definitely had to learn certain aspects of theory as things went on of like, oh, well, if it's a major two chord, then that person has to do something different. But beyond the little tweaks like that, it was introduced to us as something that you just do. So it never felt like something you learn. And as the years went on and people would like, we'd meet other musicians and we would just be doing our thing and people would say like, oh, wow, you guys know how to do that. And we would kind of look up, like we didn't realize that it was something you had to like figure out. Like we never had to like kind of drop into the third or the fifth. Like it was just something that happened rather than us having to like work at it. And I don't mean to say like, you know, we know something anybody else wouldn't. It was just when something's introduced at such a young age, it just feels innate. And I guess we have our dad to thank for that.
Yeah. I think every great singer has sort of a like somatic consciousness beyond knowing, and learning to sing before you have conscious memories is like a great way to get there.
Yeah. Like no one told me that it's hard to play guitar and sing.
Right.
And therefore it wasn't. And when I was a real bad guitar player and just singing, and other guitar players like, oh man, I'm really still trying to learn how to do that. And I was like, oh, like nobody put it in my head that that was a hurdle. Right.
So the band being a duo was the big news in 2024. And there's a lot of other big news that has gone on with you as a band and as a family, which we will get to later. But I'm curious how the shift to Dawes being primarily a duo has affected your brother relationship for both of you.
It's been great. I mean, like we in the past, we love the dudes we used to play with. But you know, when there's the more people that are in a room making a decision, the more opinions to navigate. Whereas Griffin and I were always pretty much a block. Like it was always kind of like, sure, you want us to do that work, we're there. Or we need to decide where we're going to make the record or who we're going to make it with or whatever. Like it was always pretty much in line. And now that there aren't any, you know, I don't want to say like dissenting opinions, but there's now that there's not a larger number of opinions, we're just able to get to it. And I also think like, again, I celebrate and love the years as a quartet. And I'm grateful for what that did to the sound of the band. But a lot of bands that we love have this kind of mobility, have this, like whether it's Steely Dan or Dire Straits or The Cure, or this opportunity to let the personnel change it, not change it, but just influence it, and while at the same time retaining a sense of identity. So like I said, we love the records we made as a group, as a quartet, and now I feel like we've been afforded this rare opportunity of like a new chapter, and a lot of artists don't have that. They make do with like this, they staying on that same path, and I like that that the story keeps changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll add to that. I feel like you know, communication's key, obviously, in all things in life, and because there were four of us, and we were, you know, running the operation like democratically, if you will. There was a lot of yes, 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 and you know, you're just letting everybody express themselves, and you want everybody to feel represented. Yet there's still a vision to be retained, in most cases. Mm-hmm. I feel like being able to disagree is actually much more constructive than just like, yeah, that sounds cool, you do your thing. So our ability to, you know, disagree with each other and with good intentions and not let it get offensive has been huge. I think literally like a lot of progress is born from that.
Yeah. Y'all should go to Congress. Have you thought about taking this creative partnership?
Just decide now who's on what side of the aisle.
Period.
So we can
a
get
little
this
bit of tension.
Done.
Let's get some things done. Yeah. Infrastructure done.
Debating in good faith.
Right on.
What an idea.
All right, to talk about Lenny a little bit more. It seems like Taylor, you always wanted to be a singer because your dad was a singer. And I remember when I was a kid, people would always constantly be asking me, what do you want to be when you grew up? And your answer was like, I want to be a singer. And when I finally figured it out, I was 12 years old, and people would ask me, what do you want to do? And I would say, I want to work in radio.
Cindy, that's precious.
I know, isn't it?
Yeah. And here you are.
And here I am. But it's a little different. You know, I work in radio, but it's different than I thought it would be. And even though you are a singer and have made this childhood dream come true, there still must be, like, concessions or letting go of certain aspects of that dream. So, like, what has letting go look like for you when it comes to shaping what your career has been like?
That's a cool question. I think anybody that is doing what they want or not, like they're constantly in negotiation of how to accept it for themselves. And it's a hard thing to talk about because it could slip into perceived ingratitude really quickly, and
that's tea.
Oh, okay.
This is a gay podcast.
Yeah. and so, like, for me to be like, well, I didn't get to do that, like, sitting where I'm sitting, having gotten to do the things I did get to do, is can be dicey. And but at the same time, like, I think that voice, that energy is essential to anyone who's ambitious about anything. You are going to have a voice that says, like, well, like, that's, you didn't get to play that size venue, and you didn't get this many streams or sales or whatever. And so I welcome that voice in a way that I used to feel like I needed to shut off for the sake of my just happy to be here energy. But at the same time, I need to be mindful of, like, how wonderful it all has been at the same time. But, I also think, like, anybody's trip, like, whatever they do, it's like this kind of lesson in showing you who you are in ways that you weren't even conscious of. Like, I think, you know, I never thought about the fact that we're doing this on our terms and our way, and, like, this is how we like to write set lists, and this is how we like to make records, and this is how we like to focus on appealing to this amount of people. Like, it just was never a thought. We just did whatever we wanted. And then now looking back, it's like, oh, wow, we really do embody a certain definition of independent artist. Or or like even yesterday saying on stage, like, We're gonna do no repeats for our Kayamo trip. Like, right. it's not what a big star would do, but it's also just who we've always been, and it feels very natural to us. So I think it's been a long journey in just accepting ourselves. When I can really zoom out, it's only something to be proud of. Like, there'll always be a venue that we didn't make it to. There will always be a festival we didn't get asked to play, let alone headline. Like, that's just going to be the trip. And from what I can gather, that's literally every musician's trip. Like, you see, I was talking to a friend who's in one of the biggest bands in the world, and I'm like, oh, wow, this 18,000 person venue, like, you play here. And he was like, yeah, but last record it was three nights and this time it's just one. I'm like, okay, well, sounds like we suffer from the same disease in very different ways.
You are both fathers, which we are bringing up because this podcast recently celebrated the birth of our very first baby, Miss Francie Marie, who is with us today. And we read a quote from one of
the real headliner.
Yeah, Francie Marie is the real headliner. We read this quote from you: how do we model for our kids what it means to do what you love and to be resilient and to work harder to the extent that you're able to? I want them to be proud. That matters to me more than anything now. It sounds like there's a real freedom that comes from sort of shrinking your audience down to the little person in front of you whose diapers you're changing. Can you guys speak to the freedom that comes with that shift in perspective of fatherhood?
Yeah, it doesn't change what's important. It changes why it's important. And I think, like, yeah, I think being able to do it through their eyes of, like, the idea of, like, we recently got offered to do something that's going to take us out of town for a longer chunk of time than we had anticipated. And my impulse is to be like, no, I have to be home. And obviously we manage that and we make sure that we are present fathers. But at the same time, we want them to grow up in a life where they think like, well, like dad did his thing. Mm-hmm. And not to the dismissal of their responsibilities as parents, but just they stood in their own shoes. Like they were resilient and did what they do. And that has shown me how to, eventually feel the same way about myself and put that, make that a priority, not the first priority, but make it a priority. 'Cause you don't want to lose yourself in it. I remember talking to a musician. He's a lot younger than me. But he was like, yeah, you know, my dad was wanting to be an actor and then it didn't work out because he had me and then he stopped and I resent that. And it was definitely intense. Mm-hmm. So like, whoa, your dad literally gave up his dreams to be a dad for you. But I also understand what he's saying in terms of that kind of pressure that it creates.
It's a big shadow.
Yeah. And so I think it's imperative for our kids to feel like our parents didn't give up their lives for me. They were able to do both things at once. So that then the kid is not pressured. I think about that a lot, actually, what he had said. But in the moment, it sounded pretty intense. But the more I thought about it, I was like, I think it's important to love and accept your parents. But I also do understand where mm-hmm. where he was coming from. Yeah,
it's tough to be making decisions that are going to be judged or weighed like 20, maybe 30 years from now, you know, and playing this long game. It's like I'm doing obviously what I have to do, and it's in some sense it's just non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. It's what I have to do. I literally need to go do my job to make sure that my kid can afford X, Y, and Z. And on the other hand, like Taylor's saying, I want to model what it looks like to be devoted to something and showing him that there are trade-offs. It's like I don't expect him to understand for a very long time that I hated being away from him. It mm-hmm. wasn't like I did the, it wasn't that I love my job so much that it's all good. I get to play music, and so therefore I'm having the best time. I mean, I am, and I do feel fortunate in that way. But you know, obviously the other side of that is I'm spending a weekend away from my baby. Yeah, it's just tough. It's in so many ways, it's the most. And it's the first and the most selfless thing I think we all do. And one aspect of that is that, yeah, these concepts aren't going to be wrestled with for a very long time, if at all. And so it's like, I think it's kind of a moot point in some ways, because I'm not sure that what he's going to get out of this, or what is going to be what I, you know, intended mm-hmm. him to, or that anything that I'm doing on this end of my career is actually going to influence his decisions positively or negatively. You know, I mean, it's a struggle. It's trade offs. I mean, on the other hand, it's the greatest gift, as any parent in here will tell you. So can't really complain at all.
Mm-hmm. Let's play a quick and lighthearted game about regret. What's one toy you each regret giving your kids?
Oh.
Just one.
Just one, yeah. There's a lot of those.
There's a Miss... Oh, actually, my mom is here, gave him this one. There's a Miss Rachel, like, teddy that sings that I absolutely loathe. he loves it, and it's... And it's like, well, we're changing his diaper, and he's really fussy, so we just, whatever, you know, you got to throw whatever you can at the situation. Mm-hmm. Thing always works. And it's brutal. Because I don't, you know.
Not you being haunted by Miss Rachel.
It's just that her voice, like, it occupies this register that really just, it's just right, it's like in the recesses, the deep recesses of my ear canal.
I mean, it's a case-by-case thing. Like we were just at the park, and they have someone was selling those bubble things where it makes the really giant bubbles.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm like running around making these huge bubbles, and all three of the kids are chasing it. Our 1-year-old isn't getting to pop any of them. And then like, it's fun. And then eventually like someone's not getting to pop enough, and then everyone's hysterical.
Oh,
and
no. You set yourself up for an impossible standard.
Yeah, I'm like, this is a $3 bubble stick, and now everyone's, like, on the ground freaking out. And it's like... So it's moments like that where I'm like,
bring it to Congress.
Try to create a moment, and I succeeded.
What is one movie or book or thing from your childhood that you've tried to share with your kids that they couldn't have cared less about?
My kid's too young. I mean, he doesn't. Okay. Yeah, he's one.
Okay, so pass.
All of it.
I'm starting to get wind of it now. I never read the Harry Potter books, so I'm staying up and reading like 10 pages a night, and for them, and it's exciting to get away from the picture books and exciting to get into a story that's more like long-winded, and my 5-year-old's loving it, and the other night, and my 3-year-old is like kind of getting there. He's a little bit like, what are we doing right now? And and the other night, I was reading, and I was looking at the 3-year-old who's like sitting up looking at me like, when is this gonna be over? I just want to go to bed. And but I knew that it meant a lot to my 5-year-old. He keeps asking about it, and I was like, okay. I mean, I still think it's good for the little guy. I think it's like gets him in the rhythm of it. And then after like 5 pages, I was like, Gus, he's the older one. I'm like, you like that part? And like, and then I realized he'd been asleep. So I was just reading.
I was Harry just Potter to no one.
To just one pissed off 3-year-old looking at me like, why are we doing this?
Oh, no.
That's great. So lots of people may know about this, but in January 2025, both of you and your parents suffered immense loss due to the Eaton fire that swept through Altadena. All of this stuff happened, and it was like the most stressful times of your lives. You are coming out of this situation saying, this doesn't shape who we are or shape our relationship with the world. So what has this experience taught you about healing or getting to that place where this tragedy does not define you?
It's taught me that the horizon for these things is very long. I don't think that it's, you know, we get this question a lot, like, how are you? And it's like, it's a tough one to, or how are you in regards to all of that? And it's a tough one to even answer because it's complex. I'm both things, you know. I'm simultaneously okay and also like still pretty wrecked in certain ways if I you know, think about it or approach it in certain ways. Yeah, I think it's we're gonna live in the shadow of it for a long time, yeah. And it's hard to explain to folks, mainly because it's just boring when you get into the details of lending or whatever, how pervasive it is. And you know, at this point, my son was born 2 weeks later. He came a month early, mm-hmm. presumably because of the stress, and so I was in this place of like, wow, I just lost everything, but also I had just gained the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was equal parts like horrible timing on his part and also the best timing because it kind of just reframed the whole thing. It's like suddenly I care a lot less about the you know, the lifetime collection of instruments I lost. And that's not, it's an afterthought. So yeah, it's a long process, and I do feel defined by it in a lot of ways, but mm-hmm. not necessarily in like a negative sense. It's just not something you're going to forget. It's something that needs to be integrated into every aspect of your life. There's one other thing I was going to say about this. Yeah, you got something.
Well, just... yeah, like in terms of whatever we said about like not letting it become like defining us. Like I think we both found very early that we were very uncomfortable in this role of perceived victim. You know, like when we would see friends and they'd kind of give us this wide-eyed look or this long hug and like very, very sweetly would like, "Are you okay?" And "Oh my God, I'm thinking of you." Like It was surprisingly uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just shake that off immediately. Just like, I'm good. Let's talk about that. And part of that is my own denial or my inability to confront things that that I need to process. And some of it is just feeling like this is actually my way of dealing with it. This is my way of moving forward. Not meaning to ignore it, but just to, there's a difference between not ignoring it and then wallowing in it. Like, how do I do both? How do I not wallow, but how do I not ignore? That's always a spectrum. But then also, you know, my kids are, my two of my millions of kids are older than Griff's newborn at the time, and watching them able to, you know, of course they weren't we tried to not let them be as aware of it as we were. We didn't really want to like have to put that on them to have to process. Of course they did, but we really tried to manage that. But in that whole experience, when we're freaking out about calls with insurance toxic reports or all this stuff, when you have a little kid being like, "Dad, let's play with our dinosaurs," you just realize like that is a path afforded to anybody, and actually that's the best thing I could be doing right now for him. So like
being in the present moment,
The present moment. And if they can be there, then I need to meet them there. They need me there. Mm-hmm. So that was a constant reminder of like, oh, wow, this is exactly where I need to be, what I need to be focusing on. If they can show this kind of resilience, then that means we can and we have to. Like if we wanted to meet their energy rather than force them to meet ours.
Griffin, yeah. To interrupt.
I'm just going to piggyback on that and say that every day presents like a new opportunity to perceive how this has affected us. Like it's so much of the for my wife especially, it's so much of the trauma is kind of baked into what we thought things were going to be like. Like it's mm-hmm. it's the loss is what didn't happen, and so it's weird to be mourning this future that was aborted. And it's because that. Who knows what it would have been like anyway, but a lot of, you know, whether it's childcare or the fact that we were all us and our parents were all within a mile of each other. Mm-hmm. And we had two sets of best friends within a few blocks and all these things that aren't necessarily guaranteeing an easy path, but nonetheless play into the fact that that's part of what we're mourning is the loss of the situation we had created for ourselves, yes. Especially in the wake of the child being born. And yeah, it's so anyway, it's ever developing. It feels like every Yay. Day.
Hi, Francie.
It feels like every day there's something yeah. else to mourn in that sense. But also the practice of taking stock of how actually fortunate we are relative to other people's experiences, mm-hmm. I think like in any case is important and illuminating. I mean, people are really, really struggling, mm-hmm. and by relation, we're not. Here we are, you know. We were okay. Yeah, I mean, we're extremely fortunate, and you know, I think like a life of privilege has like helped us land on our feet much more quickly than a lot of folks did. And so, yeah, not losing sight of like how much more tremendous the losses and the hill back to recovery is for a lot of folks.
Now you've talked a bit about how your son coming a month early put you in a position of letting your family and friends step in to help set up the nursery, all of these things where you were in an unexpected situation. What has your relationship been like with accepting help, both of you? How have you worked on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not inherent to me to be like, but you know, it's, I think I'm used to life being a little bit more transactional, mm-hmm. and that might be due to the fact that I've been working, I've been on tour since I was a kid. And so that's kind of what I've known. I mean, it's incredible how much people want to step up and give their time, you know, whatever they can to help. I think in that way it's been overwhelming and amazing to learn how big the community is and how willing they you all are to help when, you know, the going gets rough. So yeah, it hasn't been exactly easy for me to just be like, you know, taking a handout or whatever, but it's been so necessary. Like, I don't think that we would be in this situation. I don't think we would be remotely okay if it wasn't for the community rallying around us and the Dawes family, especially. In the wake of it, I mean, truly, like, it's, yeah, I mean, I can't express my gratitude. Mm.
Yeah, it just I guess, like, when people would reach out to help in any capacity, it helped me. It was nice to just feel seen in that way, because in this age of social media and stuff, it's so easy to, like, you know, say anything about the fire and see some comment of someone like, can't you just buy another house? You're fine.
Jesus.
And there was a lot of that, especially because my wife is, like, more of a public facing person, and everyone's like, she's fine. What are we talking about? And it got pretty hateful even. And it's two things at once. It's like, while they're not wrong that we are fortunate, it didn't mean that it wasn't traumatic and it wasn't scary. And even for reasons they would never understand, nor would it be appropriate to even share with them. Like, I'm not going to chase down every mad comment and try to, like, engage.
But here's why you're wrong.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, it was nice to feel like people understood that this is hard for anybody. Yeah. But then also it was an opportunity for us to, like, you know, put the concert together that we did, where we raised, I think it ended up being like $1 million
for
Altadena. Yeah. Because Griff's right. There's a lot of people that are dealing with so much worse situations. So many people in homes that their families had owned for so long that they didn't need to have fire insurance. And so they're truly lost with no path other than, like, this lawsuit
the government's not stepping in to forestall foreclosures. I mean, it's really ugly.
It's a big issue of, like, black justice today for those families to be restoring their homes.
There was an article written today about in the Los Angeles Times about I'm gonna mess his name up, but the lawyer Crump, he's I think it's probably not right, Ben Crump, something like that, who's very famous for dealing with, like, lawsuits involving racial injustice. Him and his team are looking into whether or not these evacuation orders being sent out late to West Altadena, which is where I was. I didn't get an evacuation warning.
Yes, we didn't ever got an evacuation.
It's unreal.
But those are historically black neighborhoods, because that part of Altadena wasn't redlined, whereas a little bit further east was, I think. Yeah, right. That's right. So I guess they're probing into the racial underpinnings of any of this. It is good, for sure. It's good. I mean, that's so heartbreaking, is that this is one of the last, all right, from what I can tell, this and Sierra Madre and some of these mountain towns in Los Angeles are some of the last, like, generational neighborhoods. And what was so cool about Altadena, and what, you know, our cohort was changing, unfortunately, was how diverse it was. Mm-hmm. And therefore, like, these black families had been there for generations and have been able to accumulate, like, wealth in a way that, like, that isn't as easy for them in other neighborhoods. So, yeah. Anyway, it's truly just tragic. I mean, it's therefore even worse, because these are the families, and often in a lot of cases that didn't have home insurance because they didn't have a loan that forced them to, and also the house hadn't been around for 100 years, and so why would we, you know, insure it when it hasn't burned down yet? And
it's good to remember that, like, American history is happening in our neighborhoods right now. And, like, we have the ability to be more conscious of what our neighbors are going through, like, even as we're struggling to get ahead ourselves, you know? Like, it's great to know that you guys are looking out for your neighbors beyond your own immediate circle. I feel like that's what moves us forward.
I agree. And I mean, it is an opportunity to do just that. And the the benefit was like, in some ways, I think it was like the most important show you've ever played. Yeah. I mean, it's never that black and white where we play and then all of a sudden someone has helped to build their house, you know, like it's usually what we offer is maybe more of a catharsis or something that's more abstract, but hopefully beneficial. So yeah, this was very rare in that sense. But also, like, I guess this is the glass half empty part of me that's like, yeah, this is amazing that we were able to do this. And but on the other sense, it's kind of like illuminating that this is going to rebuild a few houses, hopefully, and this will be like the potted versions of these houses. And there's, what, I think 8,000, you know, that need to be rebuilt in Altadena alone, something like that, around there. So yeah, it's also just like, wow, the immensity of the problem comes rearing back. And I also just think that, to your point, it's important, and this can't be said enough, but to continue to remind anybody that's looking or caring that, like, the problems have just begun there in a lot of ways. The fire was the beginning. The rebuilding process has somewhat started. Some people were able to expedite their situation, and that's awesome. So there are a couple of houses here and there. Largely, it hasn't. And I have friends that are now like getting into the lending process, and it's a nightmare. It's another nightmare. Yeah. It's a whole other thing, and it's going to be. So it's going to be as stressful, if not more so, in some ways, because it's going to ultimately dictate the future of their lives in Altadena. So anyway, that's all to say that anytime we can refocus the light to that part of the country, I'm happy to, because, you know, we don't expect people to continue to, you know, to continue to think about this. We want people to move on, because who wants to be like, you know, swimming in this mess for any longer than they have to? Obviously, like, yeah, we're cognizant of the loss, but there's a point at which I just want people to get on with their lives, because it's the healthy thing to do for all of us. But unfortunately, a lot of folks don't have that luxury, and yeah, I think it's important just to remember, like, this is not, it's just because a year or two or three or four have gone by doesn't mean this problem's fixed, you know.
In terms of the next Dawes album, are you feeling serious?
Yeah, there's probably, I think there's some lighter fare on a few of the records, and there's definitely some, like, that's my attempts at being like a little looser with certain songs on Oh Brother, and those songs are not coming up as I'm writing for the next record. Mm-hmm. I'm also not necessarily writing songs about the fire directly. You know, a lot of people would ask if I was like, ooh, that's probably going to find its way into the writing, and I feel like it has, in the sense that, like, my mood has changed and been informed, but the idea of writing about that experience, at least at the moment, sort of feels like indiscreet or opportunistic. That's not how it's landing. I'm sure you guys have heard a lot of songwriters say this, but you don't really often get to even choose what your songs are about. They like what can be written, like what enters my head is like, oh, that I can make that work. That's the song that ends up being written. I've never sat down and thought, like, I'd really like to write a song about X, Y, or Z. Like, it just doesn't happen that way. But yeah, like when it comes to the idea of wanting to process the trauma of the fire through song, like, it just feels almost ridiculous.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, your filter for you know, the reality as you perceive it, and I think like that it's obviously affected everything that we, you know.
Yeah, so like none of the songs are funny, that's for sure. Like it's I hope
yeah, what's the vibe of the new record?
Well, it's not recorded yet, but we have a handful of like side projects and stuff that we've been writing for too, so I think by 27 there'll be hopefully a nice little slew of Dawes releases.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. But
that's one thing to touch on, the us being a duo. That's one thing that that's been allowed to us now, is that we're just so nimble. And it used to be like, harder to do stuff like that because we were four, and now it's like, okay, we, Taylor and I, can kind of just slip in and collaborate in a different way. So that's opened up some avenues artistically for us as well.
Yeah. I think the next Dawes record, the standalone record, is more or less written. I'll probably get two or three more to throw into the pile. But it's a little more reflective, and it's a little less light I wouldn't call Oh Brother a light record necessarily, but when I think of songs like Mr. Los Angeles or House Parties, there's a lightness, and I'm proud of that. Those, for me at least, those songs are actually the hardest to write. And when I hear people like Loudon Wainwright or Warren Zevon or Randy Newman go into that place, I'm always like in awe of it, because it's I think writing the heartbreak song, I'm not going to say it's easy, but I do feel like it's more natural. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear even something like Dead Skunk, I'm like, wow, this is like how did this happen?
Yeah. We're all wondering.
Yeah. I mean, and it goes for Werewolves of London or Short People. Like, it always just like boggles my mind of like, what was that moment of inspiration like? And I'm like chasing it down.
Randy hits a little different though, because it always feels like it comes from this place of righteous indignation.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
correct.
How do I speak for the disenfranchised?
Yeah, he has an added dimension that Dead Skunk may not.
And we'll get to that in subsequent podcast episodes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just want to take the opportunity to say how much I love Mandy Moore.
Me too. Me too.
Girl, same.
This is a Mandy Moore fan club on stage. So there's a video of Taylor and Mandy showing their newly rebuilt house. Taylor shows you share your absolute love of books. And you were talking about, so in the video, I watched the whole thing and I'll watch it again. There's like a, it's like a movie.
It's like a screening room. I feel so uncomfortable saying that.
Mandy's like, God bless you. This is our screening room, although Taylor would call it the library. So you were talking about how when you were traveling, you were like getting people books on tour and it was like getting out of hand, but you love to seek out cool bookstores. So now what you do when you're on tour is you look for first editions as gifts for everyone back home. So,
or myself.
Yeah. Taylor. What are some hot tips you can share for aspiring first edition seekers?
Wow. Cool.
Just don't start.
Yeah.
Spend your money elsewhere.
He went there.
Save your money. Yeah. I definitely have like my stores that are in different cities. Some of them are disappearing. There was one in Asheville called the Captain's Bookshelf that was very special.
What's the top of the list?
Currently, there's a spot in Denver called the Hermitage. I think that's how I pronounce it. Yeah, they have like a back room that you kind of have to like ask about.
Okay.
Wow. It's very cool. I mean, holding like a first edition of Sirens of Titan, it was like $2,500. They did not buy it. It's a little cost prohibitive, but it was just like, just to hold these things and to know the history that they made and that they contain is so so thrilling to me. It's very nerdy. But yeah, I was just buying so many books for every one. I would buy like 8 books for every one that I finished. And it's like, okay, I'm going to die with a bunch of unread books. And I thought like, how do I correct this, but without taking away the joy I get from visiting these stores? And because I do feel like it's the last vestige of any personality in a neighborhood. It's like, coffee shops and bookstores are going to be the ambassadors of what a neighborhood's flavor is. And restaurants.
Coffee shops are so, at least in our neighborhood, there's so many that it's like, kind of just blunted the whole thing.
It's true, but it's, it depends on the neighborhood, but like even in Altadena where we are, the spots that are still open, it's like, you go in there and it's like, oh, I know these people now. And there's little flyers on the wall saying what shows I'm not going to go to are happening. And it just feels really nice. And I feel like anytime I can find that in another neighborhood, even if it's not really, even if I'm romanticizing, even if I'm projecting, I get to bask in that feeling of like, I'm in the neighborhood right now, and this town has a singular identity, and bookstores have that, especially when it has a cat in the bookstore. That I'm always sent whenever there's a cat in a bookstore.
Was there a bookstore in? All right, I'm not super familiar with LA, so there's a bookstore in LA that had an orange cat that didn't have a tail.
Whoa.
That was a Virginia Woolf invention.
Wow.
There's never been a bookstore there, Cindy.
There's one called Once Upon a Time, and that one's like mostly just for kids. It's really great, but they have bookstore
a
cat.
All right, bookstore cat is like...
Yeah, it's very cool.
It's like the bodega cats, too.
And some of these cats, they like the owners go home, and the cats have the bookstores to themselves. I love to think about that.
That's not a Disney movie. Aww. Then,
I just want to circle back to you being embarrassed about your viewing room at home.
No.
So no, it's not about you.
Okay, good.
I just want to say that my cousin growing up, his grandfather, so it was like the one that wasn't related to me, he was like a, you know, working class regular guy in suburban Boston. He had a movie theater in his basement, and we would watch like Abbott and Costello, black and white.
Oh, cool.
And he also had one of those train sets where, like, you know, you can like crawl under the table and you pop up and you're like,
oh my God.
Your cousin sounds awesome.
Like Beetlejuice.
This guy's a legend.
It was his grandfather. But like, I remember going over there and being like, so like having, you know, a lot of people have movie theaters.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah. In LA,
yeah.
It's true.
And this was like across the country. But then it goes back.
I mean, not to go dark again, but then it go like when that video came out, like some of those comments of like, oh, screw you guys, like this is not Altadena. I was like, whoa, like
the internet was a mistake.
Yeah, that's a fact.
I feel like for a couple of years there, the comments were like getting real nice, now they are.
No,
it's worse than ever. I mean,
I've been called every name.
Yeah.
People really will say anything.
Yeah.
Really just anything, and I think that's so interesting.
Interact with it. It's a vector for nastiness, but it's as real as you make it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, don't, it's literally not worth anyone's time. Any time we've ever, or Taylor has ever felt the inclination to be like, oh, you don't like that song? Well, why not? Or like engage with these assholes. It's they invariably.
He's right.
They respond.
No, they're always like, oh, sorry.
I love your band. Yeah. I didn't realize there was a human, actually. So there, I think people are deeply fucked up. And like, honestly, it's like.
I think we can all agree on that. God is great. Beer is good. People
are
crazy.
I feel sad. I feel sad for them. I'm like, the circumstances in which this comment was written are probably pretty bleak.
You're
and
a
like
nice
the
person.
Only two people seeing this comment is the person that wrote it and me. So it's like this isn't representative of any broader attitude.
They shouldn't be allowed this outsized effect that they're having.
It's just screaming at the TV energy, like put on broadcast for everyone to experience.
So fun.
Anyway, viewing room's cool. I'm accepting myself.
Great.
Should we do our lightning round?
Yes. Okay. So this is a very special lightning round for Basic Folk. This is a game called Which One? So the answers are Taylor, Griffin, or both, or neither.
And you have to respond simultaneously upon the count of three.
And we will give you a countdown. And
we'll go three,
and you won't
two,
listen to us because you'll be so excited about answering it. So it's fine if you mess up.
But I expect you to both do a good job.
Taylor Griffin, both or neither?
Yes.
Okay.
And don't get mad at us for asking these questions because we're just trying to have fun.
I can't promise that I won't be mad.
Let's just barrel right ahead then. Which one is a better driver? Three, two, one.
Griffin.
Both.
He's way nicer than me.
Okay. Which one has better fashion sense? Three, two, one.
Griffin.
This is a good one. Do you want to do the next one?
Yeah.
It's Griffin and both.
You see Taylor's fit yesterday? You saw Taylor's fit on stage yesterday? It's fucking fantastic.
Nicely done. Let's get a little round of applause for the outfits.
Okay. Which one is a better cook? Three, two, one.
Neither.
It's the self-awareness for me.
Also, I will say that, like, if you had aspirations before, being a dad has just like obliterated them. And our friend Matt said this to me. He's like, you know, once you reach fatherhood, you get kind of one thing to choose. So if your thing is exercise, then like that's what you're doing, but you're giving up everything else in any in like a hobbyistic way. And cooking is not it for me. I really dislike it.
Yeah. And we need to know our limits in this.
I hope my wife is listening to this part.
She knows. But I will say that as awful as I am in the kitchen, I'm always the first one to be like, I'll order every night. I will sort dinner every night because I feel guilty about not helping at all in that sense.
Yeah, that's the mental load.
Not to say that makes it okay, but.
Okay, this one I think is going to be a tough one. Which one is petting every dog? Three, two, one.
Taylor.
Cute. J'accuse.
All right, here you go.
Which one is better at keeping a secret? Three, two, one.
Taylor.
I didn't know.
Ooh, he kept silent. You did. You demonstrated
Taylor,
it.
Taylor.
He's keeping that one secret.
It's true. Even yesterday, my mom was telling Griff, like, Taylor doesn't rat on all the bad things you do. Yeah.
That is so
important. I was like, that's true. He doesn't really do Taylor's that much stuff, so it makes it easy. But that's true.
Too much, but some.
Which one is the life of the party? Three, two, one.
Taylor.
Okay,
I'm just
and
thinking
finally,
like the singer in the band.
Yeah. I take it back. I think he's right about that.
Okay, this is the last question because this iPad is getting very hot. Which one should I call in an emergency? Three, two, one.
Griffin.
Yes.
All right. Taylor and Griffin.
Taylor and Griffin.
Of Dawes, thank you so much for being on the pod.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, guys.
We'll see you tonight.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can find us at FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app, BasicFolk.com, or wherever you get your shows. Thank you so much to Sixth Man for having us on the Kayamo Cruise this year. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. Like, maybe you should share it with your brother, who you've been in a band with since the year 2009, and you went on a cruise with your brother and did an interview for a podcast. Taylor, can you send this episode to your brother, Griffin? Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.